listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. Each week, we bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain you while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. With me is co-host extraordinaire, psychologist, Dr. Melody Fox. Once again, we have spirited Melanie away from her private practice in Newport Beach, where she works with adults and their relationships, as well as teens and their families. Melody, how was your weekend?
Oh, my weekend was great. I had an opportunity to do a fundraiser with a youth agency that works with teens and residential treatment about what we're talking about here, trying to get coverage for with children and teens with alcohol and drug substance abuse.
That's great. All right. Now, I know that you know, that seeking financial help for mental illness or addictions can be very difficult. And getting these conditions covered by their insurance company can be a long, tedious task itself. And this all happens at a time when the last thing people need is more anxiety and stress in their lives.
I'm sitting here shaking my head.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I was going to tell everybody. She's nodding, if you know, almost with her whole body. Now, our guest today will be able to educate us as to what we should do now in this area and what to expect in the future. So with us is Monica Ose. Monica is the Chief Executive Officer and founder of Open Minds. And for the past two decades, she has led the Open Minds team perform national market research and management consulting for the health and human services industry. Now, the Open Minds team specializes in a very critical area of this field: services for people with chronic and complex health conditions, including mental illness, addictions, intellectual disabilities like mental retardation and autism, and cognitive disabilities like Alzheimer's or dementia. Monica and her team work with providers that are provider organizations, state and county governments, and insurance companies. She is well known for her numerous books and articles focused on the strategic and marketing implications of the evolving health and human services field. Monica, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Alan, I'm pleased to be here and with you and Melody.
Well, thank you. We are glad to have you. And I feel like I've gotten to know you a little bit better from the standpoint of being able to read the Open Mind Circle. The newsletter that you send out has really allowed me to kind of get an idea of what it is that you do and why it's so important.
Well, I'm pleased that you're enjoying our work. We have a great team of 75 analysts who work day in and day out to pull together all of the I would call it market and management data that providers and advocates need to kind of navigate these in very interesting and difficult times.
Well, and I know as somebody who has worked in this field now for about 30 years, we're seeing a lot of changes, and I think they're happening a lot quicker than a lot of us would like. Why do you think it has become so challenging to get the health benefit coverage for mental illness and addictions today?
Well, I think there are a couple things happening at the same time that affect every consumer and every professional who works with those consumers. Certainly, you know, the overall budget picture has been a difficult one. We have more people without health insurance now than ever before, about 20% of the population, and that includes, you know, not just people without income, but people in middle income ranges, a lot of children. So we have lack of insurance is a big issue. But the other is, even though we've had federal legislation passed to give parity or equality for mental illnesses and addictions, that's still being implemented, and I think people are a little bit unclear about what their kind of rights are under the new laws. So I think those things together really have created some confusion out there in terms of the whole issue of benefits for mental illnesses and addictions.
Oh, sure. And, you know, we've heard a lot about parity and the new law that provides better benefits for mental illnesses and addictions. And maybe you could explain a little bit what parity means and what is the new law and when does it take effect?
Mm-hmm. Well, parity, you know, it sounds like a complicated word, but I, as someone who's worked in this field for 25 years now, I really view parity is the first piece of legislation that really ends financial discrimination against people with family members with mental illnesses and addictions. So it is a set of laws, and there are really three different laws that will essentially make coverage under any, almost any health insurer provide the same level of coverage for a mental illness or an addiction as they do for someone with diabetes or cancer. So we now have the first laws that will give us that equal coverage in terms of co-payments, lifetime limits, deductibles, provide out-of-network coverage, and really give consumers with these, you know, very serious illnesses a, you know, kind of financial equality.
Now, Monica, I mean, for someone with private insurance through their employer, how exactly does the new parity law expand the services that are currently being covered?
Well, there's an important piece to understanding the new parity rules if you're looking at them as a consumer. And that is when you look at your health plan and your health plan coverage, sometime soon, because getting back to a question Melody asked, July 1 was the start of a 3-year implementation process for the new rules. So your plan may or may not right now be covered by parity, but it will be over the next 3 years kind of included in this piece of national legislation. So when you look at your health plan, the biggest advantage is if you're having a copayment for an office visit, that copayment to see your mental health professional or your addiction counselor cannot be any greater than the copayment to see your primary care doc. If you want to use out-of-network coverage, if your particular health plan doesn't have the professional that you think is the best fit for you, you now have the option to get out-of-network benefits at the same rates in terms of deductibles and copayments that you would pay if you went to see a physical health specialist who wasn't covered in your health plan. So it really is that focus on ending that financial discrimination that families face when a loved one has a mental illness or an addictive disorder.
Okay. Now, if these laws have already taken effect, why are some of the people still having trouble, I mean, getting the coverage for their mental health? Yeah. Right now, we're dealing with a lot to where the school districts are involved, that there's other things involved, and we're really seeing that they're having more trouble now than they ever have.
Well, I think there are a couple combinations of factors. We are in the transition period, and as you said, Alan, earlier, it's so difficult when people are under stress to really sort out or even acknowledge that we're in the midst of this changeover in the laws. But what we are seeing is that who pays for certain types of services is sort of shifting right before our eyes. So things that used to be covered perhaps by schools or county governments are now being moved to health plans, whether they're public plans like Medicaid or Medicare, or whether they're private plans. But there's an important piece that helped, essentially the parity legislation did not change, and that is even though we have coverage for our benefits, there is still the requirements for medical necessity and what we hear is clinical appropriateness or the least restrictive appropriate environment that our insurance companies are allowed to use to decide whether or not a particular treatment that we ask for will be paid for by the health plan. And I think particularly in mental illness and addictions, that, you know, the client and professional view of what is medically appropriate and the payer's view of what is medically appropriate tend to be dramatically different.
A lot of times I find that to be true. I could see where there's a clinical need for a client, but the insurance company just wants to deny, deny, deny. And along what we were just talking about, I have some friends that actually were on COBRA for a long time, and that ended, and they cannot find an insurance company that will insure them because they're on an antidepressant or an anti-anxiety thing. So they've got a mental health problem. The medication is helping them, but because they're on that drug, they were told that they could not get insurance. Is that going to change with all these changes in the rules?
Well, it's interesting because the good news is for those of your friends and colleagues, that has already changed. As of earlier this year, every state right now is required to have essentially a high-risk pools insurance plan that individuals can buy into, obviously, but it can buy into if they have been turned down for coverage by another insurer. So you may want to have them check out, you know, it will be dependent on what state they live in, with their state Department of Health or Department of Insurance to find out how they apply for the newly created, under health care reform, high-risk pool plan that their state offers.
Well, thanks for that information. I had no idea, and I will definitely pass it along if they aren't listening right now.
That is exactly the kind of situation that the high-risk pools are designed for. It's a stopgap between now and 2014 when all the provisions of health care reform are in place that make sure that if you've been turned down as an individual for coverage, that every state has a high-risk pool plan that you can actually buy into.
Great.
That's great to know. Let's talk a little bit about the residential treatment programs. And what I want to do is I want to go to one of the listener questions. And again, I want to thank the listeners that send these in. We appreciate them. We're glad that you take the time and know that we will always do what we can to get it on the air. This particular one says, 2 years ago, my daughter was sent to a residential treatment center for 9 months. Because of a prescription overdose, a prescription drug overdose. Prior to her departure, our insurance company required that Sarah see one of their doctors. We were happy to hear that she felt that treatment was justified, so we chose a wilderness program and off she went. 4 months in, we received a bill from the program saying that the insurance company that claimed that they would cover only the first 3 months, and that we were responsible for the balance of that for any months after that. Shocked, it was understated that we were to learn that. We didn't realize that that was going to happen. And any of the conversations that we've had since then has been nothing but a huge runaround. The bottom line is our savings and Sarah's college funds are being depleted. We hired an attorney this summer and we got a settlement for half of the uncovered costs. My question is this happening to us? Is this also what is happening to everybody else? And if so, how many other families are going through it?
Well, I would say that this is a very common situation that we see when we do consulting with groups, and that is the consumer is at the end of the communication chain. In this case, this listener's family didn't realize that somewhere in the midst of Sarah's treatment program, the insurance company had put a cap on what they essentially would pay the insurance company. The question, and I want to kind of deal with this in two ways, perhaps, Alan. One is to talk about this particular instance, and then come back and talk a little bit about residential treatment in general, if that's okay.
That would be great.
You know, in this particular instance, the question I would have for the listener is, do they have the initial documents that when Sarah went to see the insurer's, I'm assuming, medical director or medical examiner and approved the treatment program, do they have the documents that were signed or that essentially said the program was approved? Because that's the place, if I were working for them, that I would start.
Okay.
I'd go back and look and see, was there a time limit? Did they communicate, essentially, any time limit for participation in the program at that initial state? The second piece, and I will say just a little bit confused, is that typically treatment programs have a business office that when someone comes into the treatment program, they're in communication with the insurer, and they essentially get the authorization paperwork. Usually there's an authorization number. There's a clinical person working for the insurer who signs that authorization. And they should have known at the provider organization level the amount of time that the insurance company said they would pay up front. One of the things is I would go back, if I'm speaking to the listener now, mm-hmm. and get these basic pieces of documentation, because if it turned out the treatment program knew they were only authorized for 3 months, they should have communicated that to the family, so the family could have done something proactively with the health insurance company. It's very difficult to do these things retroactively, but I like to point out that 50% of all appeals are successful. So even though it's a long and sometimes tedious process of paperwork, it's really worth it, I think, to go back and maybe revisit some of those kind of basic questions about the authorization coverage early on. Does that make sense?
It does.
Sure does.
And I just to piggyback that a little bit, maybe you have some insight working as a therapist, and I've worked in like eating disorder clinics and other places where it seems like you're constantly spending more time as a clinician or case manager on the phone with the insurance companies trying to get them to approve just 3 more days, 1 more week, and for coverage for your client that's coming in. And frankly, I mean, I know I'm on a little soapbox here, but one of my pet peeves is, especially with eating disorders, is that insurance companies don't like to pay for treatment for that, yet it's not only a mental health disorder, it's also a medical necessity because people die from it. It's life or death.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems like they'll approve 1 week of treatment, maybe up to 30 days, but treatment for that particular eating disorders could take up to a year. And, you know, it's very frustrating to spend most of your time online with the insurance companies trying to get to talk to somebody to approve, you know, and authorize just a few more days. Are there any suggestions for that, or is there any way to go around that, or will that change with the new laws, or what do you think?
Well, I think a couple things. This happens to be Melody's, my professional friend. The piece of their professional life they find most frustrating is that interface with insurers.
Yes.
I mean, so I can understand exactly what you're saying. And, you know, part of it is, I will say some insurers are better than others in terms of the amount of time that they'll authorize in any particular review cycle. Some will authorize 3 or 6 months at a time, others only 2 or 3 days. And it's that piece I don't see, unfortunately, changing much in healthcare reform in terms of the frequency of those reviews, because they're somewhat based on the medical philosophy of different health insurance companies. I do think that there are a couple pieces to perhaps streamline and make the process a little more successful for the individual professional participating in that process. And you hit the nail on the head with one of them. You know, when you look at the language around essentially approving any kind of health care, whether it's physical health or an addiction or a mental illness, there's the medical necessity piece that is essentially the services to, you know, correct or diminish a particular health care problem. The piece that I think trips up people when they're looking at kind of how to get insurance covered is that second piece of language in most insurance contracts, which says they will pay the, and I'm quoting here actually from an insurance policy, the least costly of multiple equally effective alternative treatments. And what the insurer is looking for is, if I only authorize a month, I'm going to come back, look at the clinical needs of this person, and I may find that there's a less costly but equally effective alternative. For the professional and the family, you really need to have those issues around the medical condition and the functional needs of that individual lined up in that discussion with the insurer.
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah, and you know, and going back to that particular listener, and I think you brought up a great point, and that is, You know, it says that, you know, they were shocked to learn after the fact that the doctor had approved 3 months, and you brought up a great point. Well, shouldn't it be the program's responsibility to let them know that, hey, this doctor that was sent by the insurance company, in other words, they agreed to see the insurance company doctor, but the program is the one that got the information from the standpoint of it being 3 months. You know, if the program is proactive and they, if they let them know on month two that it's only 3 months, based on that, it at least gives us as the parent time to be able to get a further evaluation, either through the same insurance company doctor or we bring in one of our own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that planning, like I said, it's always more difficult to do something retrospectively. So, you know, getting in front of some of these decisions is really critical.
Yeah, and I think, too, being proactive as a parent is important, although I do totally agree that, and working in residential areas myself, is that you have to communicate with the parents. You have to tell them how much time was approved, what you're going to try to get approved, but that's not approved. They are going to be responsible for that treatment themselves, so they get a better idea. But if you're a family, and I know you're in crisis at the moment, you bring your child in or your teen in or somebody else that you love in the family, you have to still have enough presence of mind to ask them, so bottom line this, how much is this going to cost us? You know, what is this going to be? So we could budget and do what we need to do, or be proactive on our end and be kind of the squeaky wheel for the insurance company to say, hey, our kid needs this.
Well, and I do think, Melody, there are two in the, both the recent parity legislation and in healthcare reform, a couple things that are going to make this process easier, and that should make everyone happy. One of them is, under the provisions of this parity bill, any health insurer now has to make available to both the family and their professional the clinical criteria that they use for decision making. So this is really a breakthrough. It's been sort of the black box before. We call and talk to an insurer. You know, as a consumer, I never really know what they're going to approve. Now all their criteria have to be public. And starting next year with healthcare reform, we will now, as consumers, for the first time ever, have a right to file an appeal outside of the insurance company and go to an impartial third-party reviewer. So those are, I think, important changes that are coming up.
And then why don't you, I mean, share with us some of the additional changes that you see coming up in regards to mental illness and addictions as it relates to the new healthcare reform.
Well, there are a few things that I think are really pretty important to take a look at as we move ahead. One of them is that, I mean, people may not know this, but there are already pieces of the healthcare reform legislation that have become effective, and these are, I think, some really great things for us as consumers. First and foremost, you know, young people up to age 26 can now be covered on their parents' health plans. This is very important when we think about both the kind of addiction treatment for kids in that age group, and in terms of mental illnesses now, where we see the onset of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder in the kind of early 20s. There is now a prohibition against discriminating against children with pre-existing conditions, and by 2014, this will apply to all of us. Health insurers are no longer allowed to cancel your insurance or drop you from the plan because you filed a claim or plan to use your benefits. I mentioned earlier there's now high-risk health coverage available in every state if you have applied for coverage and been turned down. And starting September 1st, there was the elimination of annual and lifetime limits in health plans, which has always been, prior to parity and health care reform, such a financially crippling issue for families with children or loved ones with a mental illness or addictions. So, and I mentioned we have the new independent appeals process, which is really a first in terms of American health insurance systems. So these are the provisions that are effective now. There will be another kind of set of provisions coming up in January and February as we kind of move ahead with the implementation of the reform laws.
Now, I had a question regarding coverage for children up to age 26. Are they still required to be a dependent child, such as someone that's still on the parent's tax return, or can they be a married adult child, or how does that work?
Well, and my understanding is that any dependent, and I don't know that they actually use in the law the word dependent, but I will actually check on that and get back to you after the show. But the way the language is worded is that any child up to age 26 may at their election be covered by their parents' health insurance.
Nice.
So, but I will check on that and get back to you so you can update your listeners.
Because I know a lot of young people that get married at 24, 25, and I was just wondering at that point, are they considered not under their parents' responsibility or care?
Right. Yeah. No. It's a great question, and I know that you know we've worked with some that although they have maybe gone out and gotten married, that doesn't mean that they still aren't dealing with certain issues.
They're still very childlike.
That's right. All right. Well, we're going to take a break. We will be back. We are speaking with Monica Oz. She's the CEO of Open Minds, and we are talking about how to get mental health and addiction expenses covered by insurance. We'll be right back.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
All right, we're back. And again, we're talking about how to get mental health and addiction expenses covered by insurance. Monica, I think just when we left, we were talking a little bit about the health care reform plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, let's go into, I mean, kind of the basic plan. I mean, will everyone have insurance? I mean, that's what they're telling us. But, I mean, is that true? And if so, how will that happen?
Well, the answer to that is yes, almost everyone will have insurance under the health care reform plan. And it happens in, I like to think, in kind of four components. First of all, and this is, I think, a great misunderstanding, Medicare coverage for people who are 65 and over and for citizens with disabilities will continue as is. So there's no change in the kind of large percentage of the population covered by Medicare. Medicaid, or in California, Medi-Cal, will actually be expanded to provide coverage for anyone who is making less than what they call 133% of poverty. But what that translates into for those of us in the real world is if you make less than $14,000 a year as an individual or $25,000 for a family of three, you'll be enrolled in Medi-Cal and at no charge to you as an individual. So we're going to see an expansion there. The third leg of health insurance reform is that all employers with 50 or more employees will be required to provide health insurance coverage for their employees. There are a number of options, I mean, from, you know, kind of the bronze plan to the platinum, but employers will be required to provide insurance. And the good news, if you happen to be an employer with 25 or less employees, is that the tax credits for the smallest of employers pay for almost all of the cost of providing health insurance. And then the last leg, and the one that gets, interestingly enough, the most publicity, both good and bad, is that if you're not covered by Medicare or Medicaid or your employer, there is a mandate for individuals to buy health insurance from their state's health insurance exchange. And if you make $88,000 a year or less for a family of four, there actually is a tax credit that will allow you to purchase health insurance through the state health insurance exchange. So our goal, my hope, and we'll see as this rolls out, is that like other countries, if you look at England or Germany or Canada, there are 2 to 3% of the population that are uninsured, not 20%. But that's kind of a quick summary of a very complicated kind of healthcare reform plan.
Now, I have a question. When does that go into effect again? For I'm particularly interested if you're an employer and you have 25 or less. I like the idea you get a tax credit that almost covers the cost of that, the coverage. But when does that go into effect?
Well, the good news is for all of small employers out there, that tax credit is already in effect. And, in fact, we track all the national insurance statistics. We've seen the number of small employers with 25 or less employees offering health insurance go up by almost 15% just in the last 6 months, because now they get a tax credit that covers almost 100% of the cost of the insurance.
Okay. Now, continuing about this 25 or fewer employees, do you have in your open mind circle, have you touched on that with one of the articles? Because that's one that I know I personally would like to read. And if it's something that has already started, how do we go about making that work?
Well, you know, Alan, that is a great idea. We have not written specifically about that provision of the health care reform bill, and that's something that I'll make sure we get on the docket for next week and provide all the details about the tax credit. It's really a very important issue when you look at kind of insurance, and particularly the uninsured. That smallest group of employers is actually where we have the highest number of working individuals without insurance. But we'll be sure to cover that, and we will cover it next week on Open Mind Circle.
All right. Now, can you tell our listeners how can they get the Open Mind Circle? And again, I already get it, and I think it's great. But tell everybody, you know, the website, where they can go to be able to subscribe to and get the Open Mind Circle.
Yeah, for more information, you just go to www.openminds.com. You can sign up for a free membership in the Open Mind Circle. As Alan mentioned, every day we actually track what we think are the most important marketing and management issues affecting the health and human service field, and we are very focused on this, the area that I think is tremendously underserved, and that is consumers with those chronic and complex conditions like mental illnesses and addictions. So again, openminds.com.
That's great, and it's a great website. I went to it this weekend and took a look at it. I was wondering, too, after this last election, we've been hearing a lot about repealing the health care reform bill. Do you know what that means, or what it would happen, or if it might happen? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm certainly not, I may be a market analyst, but I'm certainly not a political guru. But the political folks that I trust really say that they find it very unlikely that health care reform will be repealed. And I read an interview with the president of Eli Lilly, some of the heads of the Republican caucuses, kind of Democratic House leadership. I mean, across the board, I think people are saying we don't expect widespread repeal. What we do expect, and I don't think this is a bad idea, is that there will be a vigorous debate about a lot of the provisions in the health care reform bill. But I think some of the things that are surprising is when you look at the public opinion polling about American consumers and their perceptions of health care reform, I would say right now when you ask them the question, are they in favor or not in favor, the response is pretty evenly split, 40-40, with about 20% with no opinion. When you go down the list and ask them about the individual provisions, like should young people be able to get health insurance through their parents, should we end lifetime limits, should insurance companies be able to discriminate based on pre-existing conditions, generally speaking, the public supports those individual provisions, kind of 70-30. Mm-hmm. The only one where there is, I think, a lot of mixed feelings from a consumer perspective is if you don't get coverage elsewhere, should you be compelled to buy health insurance like you are to buy car insurance? So it's a long way of answering your question, Melody, that the kind of policy people that I read really feel repeal won't happen, but there will be some modifications to the bill.
Yeah, I don't think I necessarily agree with people that can't afford it to pay for it if they really can't afford it, because nobody knows what a person can or can't afford or a family can or can't afford. Mm-hmm. Because the you know, people's wages and living expenses are different wherever you are in the country, and I don't think they could do a full sweep and tell them, oh, you make under or you make over 20,000 between 20 and 50, so now you have to pay something.
And I think that is, you've hit the nail on the head. That is probably the, you know, of all the provisions in the healthcare reform bill that affect consumers, that one is the one where I would say that opinion is the most mixed.
Yeah, it's very subjective on that.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to go, we've got some additional listener questions, and we've got one here that really touches right on the mental and medical health care. This one says, many of us in the field of mental and medical health care are truly disgusted with insurance companies that pay significant incentives to employees and doctors who routinely deny insurance claims. The new law provides some improvement, but I believe falls short when addressing this very corrupt practice. What is your opinion, and is there anything in the works to fix this situation?
Well, and I'm assuming, Alan, if I can just get a little bit of clarity on the question, I think we're talking about kind of the routine denial of care on the first go-round of a practice that is in place with some insurers.
I mean, and I think that would be my guess, too. Again, this came in through the email, so we know that it's someone that's in the field and probably in that position to where they're seeing these denials or in some cases where they're giving, you know, you have somebody that comes in with a particular need, and most people believe that the general practice to take care of that need is something that may take 30, 60, 90 days, and they go, we'll give you 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's almost as bad, maybe worse than the denial.
Well, I think I do agree with the listener that we will get some relief both from those provisions in the Parity Act and under health care reform that I mentioned. It is certainly not a perfect solution, and I think one of the things I strongly recommend is I don't think that there's anything wrong with advising consumers to change health insurance plans if we think the health insurance plan that they're enrolled in is a particularly bad actor in terms of trying to discourage people from accessing care. And this piece will get easier when we see in 2014 a health insurance exchange where there will be more options for more people to elect in terms of their health insurance coverage. The other piece, and I know this is kind of cold comfort for the caller, is, again, our experience is that more than 50% of appeals are successful, and it is really worth the time and effort to, if you will, train your insurance company that, in fact, you're going to be persistent in following through on this process, in filing appeals, in writing those letters, I mean, going through that standard process. Because what that does from an insurer perspective is, and I have seen this happen, insurers step back and say, you know, we always lose the X kind of case, and we should just change our policy and be approving those things so we're not using up, you know, a lot of administrative time denying claims. But it is definitely a mixed bag right now, both positive and negative.
And I know you just touched on some of the things that a family can do, like be diligent and following up on the appeal. But if a family disagrees with the decision of the insurance company, are there direct ways or steps that you would suggest they should do first, second, third, fourth in order to get that appeal and try to make that happen?
You definitely, Melody, there's a very organized process that you want to follow. It doesn't have to be expensive or time-consuming, but you want to, A, make sure that, you pull out that insurance, information that you got back when you signed up for your plan and read through what is the appeals process, that you follow the health insurance company's appeals process in terms of requesting that they change their denial of authorization or change whatever it is that they did to essentially prevent you from getting the care you and your professional think you need. You need to keep all the stuff needs to be in writing. And now we have two things that kind of work in our favor. One is that we now will have copies of their decision-making criteria, courtesy of the parity legislation. So as you write your letter or work with your professional to write your letter or file your appeal, you want to make sure you know what those criteria are and you can point out if they've kind of varied from their own criteria, which happens a fair amount. If you're turned down, there usually is a secondary appeal process. Now there actually will be the opportunity, courtesy of healthcare reform, for an external appeal. And I know this sounds a little bit far-fetched, but in the end, if I have not, as a consumer and someone who works with a lot of my friends and family on resolving health insurance issues, if I haven't gotten kind of satisfaction, I always let my insurer know that I plan to send the Department of Insurance copies of my correspondence. And that, in many times, in some step along the way, like I said, I have a very good track record, over 50% of getting the insurance company to change their mind about their initial decision.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was also curious too. How involved should a professional be or can be without overstepping any boundaries while trying to help their clients and the families in working with the insurance companies?
How involved should the professional be?
Or is there a line that they need to stop, being there?
Well, I think there are two things. I really recommend that every professional and every provider organization needs to be a source of information for consumers about understanding their health benefits and this process. And we do see some of the advocacy groups now, children's advocacy groups for people with addictions and mental illnesses, being the source of here's the process you want to file and helping them with the basic steps in the process. Where I think it's critical that the professional be involved is at some point the consumer is going to need the, if you will, clinical expertise to say, here's exactly why you, Melody, as my professional, recommended this particular treatment, so I can include that in my letter and my appeal. But you really do want to, I'm all about, kind of the professional helping the consumer and the family kind of be empowered to address this issue as much as they can on their own.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, and while we're talking about the coverage, how successful are you seeing it now where there's conversion of coverage? And I remember some years ago where we were in a situation to where many people were able to contact the insurance company and say, look, right now the coverage says that my child can be covered for up to 30 days on an inpatient situation. But within that 30 days, they might spend $60,000 or $70,000 just in that 30-day period. And in some cases, we're setting up a conversion based on a recommendation that may be going to a wilderness program for 6 to 8 weeks that might cost, half that, might be better suited for them. How successful is that? I know there was a time in which some of the insurance companies were listening to that and making those decisions. Is that still happening that you know of?
That, Alan, is still happening and is a great idea with one caveat, and that is, and this is always the challenge for those of us when a loved one has any kind of health problem, is that proposal needs to happen early on in the process. So it really is, if you have a child who has a mental disorder or an addiction, and looking at, we are willing essentially to swap out our benefit and convert from kind of the use of this intensive treatment program to, you know, well, intensive treatment in a hospital, which is always very expensive, to some other programmatic approach. Many times we find that the insurers really are willing to listen to that, particularly, and I like to underscore this, particularly if the professional and the provider organization are kind of on board with, you know, accepting the payment from this conversion process. But that's really an important piece for anyone with a chronic disorder, is to think in those terms with their insurer.
Right. So, and what I hear you saying, so again, so everybody out there will understand, is you're saying start the process early. Do this before you send them to the wilderness program. Don't go, look, we sent them to wilderness and, you know, we've started the ball rolling in regards to making payments for that. What you're saying is that beforehand, tell them that, look, for instance, today is, you know, it's in November. And we say, look, right now it's set up to where there's a $100,000 cap per year for in-house psychiatric treatment. Well, between now and the end of the year, they'll burn up $100,000, and next year they'll start another, and they'll, in other words, it could cost the insurance company $200,000 in the next 3 to 4 months, and then stipulate essentially to them that we will, you know, if you will say that it's okay to convert it to wilderness and boarding school, where it will only cost $100,000 in the next 2 years, we will sign something saying that we won't come back and then try to gain more cost. Is that kind of what we're saying?
Well, that's exactly it. And there's an important, you know, change that's just happened, because as of, you know, as of September 1st, the new health plans that are coming on board no longer can have those annual and lifetime limits. So what you see is, and it, you know, most health insurers, when they see someone who has a chronic condition like an addiction or a mental disorder, they're going to be thinking more long term now about how do I find an alternative for someone who, if not put in a stable place and if their disease isn't under control, could be cycling in and out of the hospital frequently, which is bad for them,
right,
and expensive. So, yeah, and really, you know, I think it's thinking proactively about the needs of people who have these really chronic and tough-to-treat conditions.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we have another comment. We have a listener comment. And I think if there was anybody in the that works for the insurance companies or the government that was listening, they might want to hear the basic theme that's coming from the listener questions, and it's people that aren't happy. This one is a comment that says, I am very unhappy with the way healthcare has been approached in Washington. The healthcare bill seems to be more about making all of us pay for insurance instead of the healthcare that we all need. In fact, insurance companies should be required to be nonprofit organizations to take the greed element out of the formula. If one were to emerge, that is certainly where I would put my money. What do you think of that comment?
Well, I think that represents the opinion of about 30% of the American population when we do polling, which is there are a third of the population who actually think the health care reform bill didn't go far enough and should have gone beyond essentially insurance reform and gone to restructuring the delivery of healthcare in the United States. The challenge, and I'm glad I'm not in the hot seat of a political office, the challenge is we also have 30% of the population who think we should have no, you know, essentially universal coverage at all. And I think what we're struggling with as a country is trying to find where's the, if you will, the political sweet spot where we can get everyone on board, even if it's not their first choice.
Right.
But the caller certainly, you know, represents a sizable portion of the population who would like healthcare reform to go a step further and go into restructuring the system.
Right. And I believe the politicians refer to that as capture the middle.
Mm-hmm. You were absolutely right. It's that trying to, you know, walk that, I always call it the narrow channel that's kind of right down the middle.
Well, Monica, I have just looked at the time. I cannot believe that the time has flown by, but I want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
I think you have covered so much ground. I would love to be able to have you back. I think there's so much more that we could also go over. So again, I want to remind everybody, if you want to continue to gain some of this information, you can go to openminds.com, and there is the Open Mind Circle. It is a newsletter. Again, I get it often, and each time I read it, I feel like I'm being enlightened in something new that's going on in our country.
Well, Alan, Melody, it's been a pleasure, and I would welcome the opportunity to be back again. And, Alan, you can look for that coverage on the tax credits in one of next week's editions.
Great.
We'll both look forward to that. It's Open Minds. Could you give the website again?
Yep, www.openminds.com, and you can sign up for our free newsletter.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. All right. Well, and again, if you're driving, if you couldn't write that down, you can always go to our website. It's www.answers4thefamilyblog.com. And you can submit questions. You can submit ideas for upcoming guests or topics that you would like us to discuss. And until next week, seek to catch someone doing something good every day. Bye now.
To Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.